Welcome to Calibrate Conversations, a podcast about embracing God's standard for sexuality. I'm your host, Brady Cohn, and joining me today is our guest, Crystal Nelson. So, Crystal, you are joining us from the great state of Florida, but you're a Nebraskan. And so, in my eyes, that gives you instant credibility to everything you have to say. So, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for letting me come. I'm excited.
So, Crystal, you have spent the last 20 years ministering to teenagers, and I want to hear about some of that experience, but we also want to dig into some of the content of your new book, which is so apt for teenagers, called Toilet Tales. And so it's really awesome. I've never seen a book or read a book that had so many bathroom jokes, and I love it.
It's my ode to middle school boys. I was like, I worked with them for so long, I had to bring them in, you know?
Yes. Poop jokes have never been my favorite, but they're definitely a number two.
So that's actually kind of a poop joke.
Exactly. So you got it. I didn't know if you'd get that. So, or you could say that they're a solid number two.
Yes, that's really good.
Yes. Okay, I'll have to stick with that. I'll write that one down. Cool. So you tell us about your experience in youth ministry and what led you to write this book. And then we're going to dig into some of the actual content, because we have parents who are struggling and to figure out how do we navigate life with teenagers. It's such a crazy world that I think a lot of parents are either ignorant to, or they've just given up, or they're just overwhelmed with what's going on in life of my kids and our teenagers, social media, what's happening in our schools. We've had now a few years of just kind of mass instability with COVID and kids' lives being disrupted. And so they need some stability and some investment in them now more than ever. And so tell us what led you to write this book.
Well, I started working with teenagers while I was still a teenager. So we started a youth group at my church, my cousins and I did, and we started a traveling soccer team. And we just recognized that our peers, so this was back in the 90s, were just, you know, lost. I think the town, I grew up in Alliance, Nebraska, and we had the highest teen pregnancy rate per capita. And we're like, there's so much more to life. And we would have so much fun and just wanted kids to recognize that there's so much more fun than just drinking and partying all the time. And so then I started working at a summer camp called Camp Rock outside of Bridgeport, Nebraska. And I was a counselor every summer for years. And we would travel around to small towns and do little Bible studies with kids. And I was leading Bible studies and training leaders and teaching. I'd teach classes every week at the camp in front of, like, the whole camp would come together. And I'd have, like, a Bible class sometimes. And I talked a lot about missions. I was really passionate about how powerful our prayer is, number one, and how important prayers are. And then the importance of just of sharing the good news with people and just the power that Jesus has to change lives. And then I went to college. I went to Colorado Christian University in Lakewood, Colorado, which is CCU, which was awesome, and was in missions. And we did some homeless outreach work there. And I started, you know, you have to take sociology classes and history classes. And so that was kind of just like learning and being in college, its own experience. And then I tried to get away from kids and I sold insurance for 2 years and I cried almost every single day, except for when I was working with kids at church. That was the happiest part of my life. So then I moved to Rapid City, South Dakota. And I ended up getting a job at a pregnancy resource center teaching sex ed. And that was like my sweet spot, because kids always laugh if you talk about awkward things like sex. And so I was a comedian and I didn't even have to try. And I would travel from schools and reservations and started, and we would do trainings for parents on prevention education and brain development. And then that job kind of morphed into drug and alcohol prevention for teenagers. And so we were teaching teenagers to reach teenagers to live a drug and alcohol life, free life, and how to have fun without drugs and alcohol and all these things. And so that part of my life wasn't really faith-based, but it was just when I would teach sex ed, I would teach about love. Like, what is it? What isn't it? How are guys' brains and girls' brains different? How they view one another, how they view love, how they interact in relationships. And then we would talk with parents and be like, parents, it's so important for you to be the bad guy in relationships. And I had just some amazing counselors that I worked with that I worked at Youth and Family Services and Lifeways. And we'd bring in people and they'd be like, this is the latest brain scans that we found out. And this is why the teen brain is the way it is, which is a big part of my book. Because
yes,
for myself, when I became a teenager, I had this like beautiful relationship with my mom. And then I became a teenager and suddenly like, I really loved her and I really hated her all at the same time. And it was this tension that I struggled with so much. And I could see my mom struggling with it too, because I knew she loved me and like wanted to be my best friend, but still had to be my mom. And I wanted to be my best friend, but she's, you know, still had to be my mom. And I wanted to be in control, but wouldn't have been a good person in control. And so we were constantly battling and I just felt like something was wrong with me. And then when we did these trainings on the teen brain, I was like, oh my gosh, it was my brain. It was a season in life. And all these teenagers went through this, and it just changed how I looked at teens and how I understood them and interacted with them. And I ended up, we did it at Youth and Family Services and after school drug and alcohol prevention program for their girls program. And I ended up going to Taiwan to work with a missions organization. And I brought this little puppet with me that I had taught all these prevention education classes with, and the puppet would go around and like send messages back to the kids, and just that relationship and that community building and meeting kids overseas and talking with them about similar topics. And I'm like, oh, kids in Taiwan are struggling with the same things as kids in America. And we'd sit down with these teenagers and they're like, I just want to like struggling with depression and suicide and who am I and am I okay and where do I belong, and the three questions that every teenager is asking. And which really became clear to me in when I came back to the States after about 2 years in Taiwan, worked for Lifeways, the drug and alcohol prevention stuff. And I learned a lot about the importance of not treating people who have gone through hard times as victims, but survivors, and learned to listen and not react. And then I started working for Young Life, which is a missions organization that really focuses on kids who don't really connect with church or have never been to church, and building relationships with them and earning the right to share the gospel with them. And we did more trainings, and this guy named Chap Clark just talked a lot about identity and how every kid is asking these three questions: who am I, where do I belong, and do I matter? And so in my book, then that's the chapter on, is it number one, number two, or three? Back to your joke. So in all of that, I learned in different studies that we were doing when I worked for the nonprofits that weren't Christian and we were government funded, we had to read a lot of government studies, and I was training to be a counselor. And they said, the most important people in a kid's life is their parents. And even though they often treat them the worst, they need them the most. And their voice is so powerful. And so I then made it a point as I was working with kids to try to get to know their parents, because I was like, if this is the most important relationship, if I can help that relationship, I will ultimately help that kid.
Absolutely.
And someone had once said that whoever you work with, you have to be careful because you'll start to dislike whoever they're kind of against. So for example, so if you work with teenagers all the time, it's easy to start seeing parents and adults as the enemies. If you work with parents and adults all the time, it's easy to start seeing kids as the enemies. If you work with the poor, it's easy to see the rich as the enemy. If you work with the rich, it's easy to see the poor as the enemy. And so learning to keep that balance, to not be offended by either one, but to recognize that everyone is dealing with things and going through things. And so I just started to have kind of this heart for parents. And I would have these conversations over and over again with parents, and they would often say, well, I know I don't think anyone else is going through that. Like, don't let anyone, it was like this secret. You could just tell, like, they were almost ashamed to tell me whatever it was that they were struggling with, which was often like the number one thing that I would say. So many parents like would say to me with just like secret shame, I just like, I love my kid, but I don't like, and I don't really like them. And sometimes like I think these thoughts, you know, and I'm like, you're normal. This is what every parent struggles with. Like, this is, you know, and they're like, what? And so when I retired from youth ministry and my husband and I were moving into our marketing business, and I've always wanted to write and felt like I was supposed to write. And I thought I was going to write a novel, and I joined this writing program, and the lady's like, all right, come up, like, you know, ask the Lord, what does he have on your heart to write? And I kept trying to think of a novel, but instead I just kept coming back to like all these conversations with all these different people. And so I just threw together this outline, and I started thinking about how everyone has a bathroom in their home and everyone uses it all the time. And everyone has bathroom stories, but you never talk about them. I mean, like people like me do and embarrass others, but for people who are teenagers, you know, but most people, that's the secret room. What happens in the secret room stays in the secret room. And I was thinking how teenagers are like, they're kind of the bathroom time of your life. Like they bring it all out there. It's all there. No matter
the
how
good, the bad,
are,
the
they,
ugly, and the smelly sometimes.
Yes. Sometimes it's like the most incredible. Like you shower, you bathe, you come out like this new stunning person. But sometimes it's not so pretty in there. That's what teenagers are, the highs and the lows and everything. And you can't control them like at all. And
when they have to go, they have to go.
Yes. Yes. The other thing I found is just so many parents carry so much shame. Like they just feel absolutely. Like I'm the worst. I'm a failure. If I would have just done this. And I remember one time, I can't remember where we were studying, but we were going through, I think it was the 10 commandments, and just kind of like meditating through the 10 commandments and really looking at like, what do they say? How do I apply this to my life? What did it mean to the people at that time? What does it mean to me now? What will it mean? What are the timeless truths? And I hit the honor your father and your mother. And I was like, oh, he doesn't say honor your father and your mother if they're good. Honor your father and mother if they made no mistakes. Honor your father and mother, like, if you love them really well and they're super awesome people. He just says, honor your father and your mother. There's no age limit on it. There's no definition of what that looks like. And I was thinking about how God is like, calls himself the father of Israel. And then you read the Old Testament and you're like, you know, all the prophets are like, Israel, my child, what are you doing? Why did you leave me again? And I'm like, here God is like perfection, perfect love, knows everything. And his kids like still don't listen to him, still do really stupid things, even though he has done everything perfectly. And I was like, oh, how gracious of God to be like, honor your father and mother, because it is freaking hard to be a parent. And until you are, you will not know how hard it is. And it just gave me so much more grace for parents after that, because I was like, this is the hardest thing you'll ever do. And God, who is perfect, didn't control his kids out of love. You know, he could have, but it would have been ugly. And so who are we as parents to think that we can be more perfect than God, and that our identity or our value comes out of our kids' performance? Because God certainly doesn't. Like, if God's value Absolutely. Is based upon us.
And you know, one of the things you talked about in the book, I have a quote right here. Just the first sentence is, one of the greatest disservices we do in today's youth is trying to get our value from them. And I see that so much in my ministry to parents and kind of observing, you know, what's going on in the Christian world, or all of the world, but, you know, I spend a lot of time in churches, and parents are so consumed with their value comes from their kids. And sometimes we've built this image-based culture where there's shame if, you know, if anyone knew what my family was struggling with, and it turns out they're all struggling with it, or parents finding their identity, their value from their child's athletic performance, or, you know, and we come from small towns, so everyone knows one another. So image is such a big deal. And so that puts such a weight on our kids when we're finding our value from them, because we're really putting them in the place of God, and they're going to be crushed underneath that weight. So instead, we need to have the type of faith where we have everything we need in Jesus as parents. Our value is from the Lord. Our identity is in the Lord, and therefore we can love our kids unconditionally because we don't need something from them. Instead, we can offer them an identity and love that's unconditional and speak value into their life, because we already have everything, so we don't need to take from them. We can pour out and give to them.
Yeah, there's Chap Clark. He, I don't know if he still teaches at Fuller Seminary, but he did for a long time, and he did a lot of our trainings when we first started with Young Life, and he talked about, if you look back at just sports teams in, I think he said like the 1920s. And you'll see that the picture is just a ragtag group of kids and they're just playing sports. And the coach isn't even in the pictures. And then we progress through the years and the father leaves the home from the wars. And pretty soon we have these fatherless homes. And then pretty soon you see the teams and it's like, they're all like this perfect looking team. And then now you see the coaches and then now you see the coaches and the parents. And oftentimes you go to these sports games and you're like, is this about the game or the parents? Like, hard to know.
Yes.
And these kids feel this pressure to perform for all of these people. And so then they tend to react by either overperforming or a lot of times just shutting down. If they don't feel like they can perform, then they just quit performing. And so then the value is in like, if you do good, then I'm okay. And so we see these parents living vicariously through their students. Then we see the teachers living vicariously. Like, you're not a good teacher unless the kids are performing well. So then the teachers suddenly have to have their value, you know, and we're getting all this evaluation from these kids who truly don't know who they are. They don't know anything about life. They haven't lived life. They're just trying to figure it out. Their hormones are going crazy. Their brains aren't even fully developed. And we're like, am I doing a good job parenting? Like, tell me I'm good. Tell me I'm an okay parent. And you're just like, they don't know. They can't tell you. And just absolutely. Like you said, it's crushing for them.
Yes. One of the quotes that I wrote down from your book is this. It says, kids and teens are amazing observers. They don't miss a thing, but they are horrible interpreters. They need you to help them actually understand reality. And I think that is so true. Because kids notice everything, but they need help processing what's the truth behind that observation. What does that mean? And so many times when kids are observing at every stage of development, they're maybe misconstruing reality, not understanding reality. And so we have to help them understand what does that mean, which means we have to know them deep enough and have a relationship that's deep enough that we can understand their emotions and what are you processing? What are you interpreting? How are you observing the world around you? And many times I've seen kids' issues come from just misinterpreting what they've been observing. And I see that own life, you know. When I was a kid, it's like, oh, I'm unloved. I'm not valuable because I was observing all these things. But then when I had no one to process it with, I was then misinterpreting. And then I was believing all kinds of lies about myself and about the world and about who I am because I had no one to process, put in the right categories and explain what I was, you know, really observing.
Oh, yeah. I saw that in multiple. I mean, the funniest one was I was friends with this high school girl and her mom, and they were both like the mom one day had just been like, oh, it's frustrating, but we worked it out. It was something with like the daughter cleaning her room, which is like every mom I ever talked to seemed to struggle with their daughters or their kids cleaning their rooms, you know, and her interpreter, and she told me what had happened and it was like, but I think it's good, you know, da, da, da. And then a couple days later, I end up talking to the daughter and she's like, oh my gosh, I got into this whole, like she describes this scenario with her mom that was just horrible. Like her mom was just like, I was like, oh my gosh. Okay. I like couldn't even imagine it. And then it was so like the details of it and how she interpreted it. I would never have guessed they were the same scenario until there was one thing that she said. And I'm like, wait, when was that? What day was that? And I'm like, wait, these were the same days. What time was it? And then what ultimately had been asked of you? And I was like, oh, you live two totally different scenarios. It was like night and day in their interpretations of those stories. And then another one, which I think I put in the book, I was talking to this middle school girl and she was like, Crystal, I'm pretty sure that I am, what did she say? Bisexual or pansexual. I can't remember off the top of my head at the moment, but, and I was like, oh, okay, well, why do you think that? And she's like, well, you know, like, and she was probably about seventh grade. I don't really like the color pink anymore. And I used to love pink and I used to love dresses and I loved my stuffed animals. I mean, I still like my stuffed animals. They're still important, but I just don't love them the same way. And I just want to wear hoodies all the time. I don't know why, but I love hoodies and black. Like, and so I'm pretty sure that I'm.
Wow. So talk about jumping from observations to horrible interpretations.
Yeah. And I was like, well, did you know that it's normal when you're in middle school to not like the same thing? And she's like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, it's really normal to not like the color pink anymore. Like that changes for a lot of people. And it's okay to not want to play with your stuffed animals and not want to wear dresses. And I don't know why, but I've yet to meet a middle schooler who doesn't love hoodies. Like, it's just
Yes. And what a great example of when a child discloses something, instead of flipping out, just asking questions. What do you mean by that? You know, what makes you think that? What's your definition of that? Because they're growing up in a completely different world where some of these concepts are so foreign to our parents, but I don't think they're that much different. There's just different language. And so just by simply asking, what do you mean by that? What does that mean to you? And why did you come to that conclusion? You know, you can get to the bottom of it. And then it turns out, with the right interpretation of what they're feeling, they can pretty easily come to the right conclusion sometimes, or have the right category to fit these different feelings into.
Yeah. And most teenage girls and teenage boys, when they're going through puberty, don't feel comfortable in their bodies. Like,
yes,
their bodies feel foreign and alien to them. And so this particular girl, and actually not just her, like a ton of kids I know who spent most of their time online, that's where she was like, yeah, I don't feel comfortable in my body. Oh, well, then maybe you're the wrong gender. Oh, then maybe you're this and this. And I was like, okay, that's a horrible way
yes.
to get to that
and
point. Like,
that's what social media is telling them, especially TikTok. I have so many parents who are in such horrible situations with their kids because their kids have been convinced that, you know, I'm the wrong gender. I was born with the wrong body. And all these social media influences tell them, if you're uncomfortable with your body, then, you know, you might be transgender or you might be this. It's like every teenager is uncomfortable with their body, but we have to shepherd them through that. And we have to give them positive affirmation and help them develop a healthy identity. And that's part of helping them go from observers to interpret for them that this is what you're experiencing and it's okay. It's good. This is part of the process, and cheer them on, you know, every step of the way.
Well, and I think too, even just to have, cause I remember from my, having the space with parents to just at different times share about life with their kids, especially when you know your kids are going to be coming up on like changes from puberty, from being a little kid to an older kid. And I remember my mom telling me, I was probably 10 or 11. She goes, I just want you to know that it's okay if someday you don't like me. And actually, I think I wrote about this in the book too. And she said, because when she went from being a little kid who loved her mom to being a high schooler who suddenly didn't like her mom anymore, it was so shocking for her. And she was stunned by it. And then she realized that it was kind of a normal thing. And so she wanted me to know that if I ever experienced that, if I ever experienced not loving her, or like being angry at her for some reason, that was okay. And that was probably a part of just me becoming a teenager. And that was so good, because then when it did happen, it was shocking. And then I realized, I was like, oh yeah, but it is okay. Like, my mom told me that this would happen. She told me this was going to be okay. And I think hearing those stories helps you, and hearing other people's, that's why I do talk about tribes so much and like community within the book, because hearing different people's stories, like, you don't know what your kids are going to go through, but somebody else might go through something that your kid's going to hear and that's going to resonate with them. Or, you know, so having really good people in their life, and you hear these life stories of what happens, but now we get together and we just watch TV or we're on our devices, and we don't tell stories like we used to. And the storytelling of like how you got to where you are and how your family got to where you are is so important. One, for giving identity for kids to know where they came from, but also just preparing them for challenges that come up in life. Like, oh, that was really hard, but I know my grandparents went through these really hard things because I heard their stories. So I can go through this because people in my life have, versus you never hear about the hard things. And then a hard thing comes and you're like, oh my gosh, what has happened? And so we have entire cultures of kids who haven't been raised on any stories. They have no idea what their parents went through to get to where they are, or their grandparents, or their aunts,
there's
their
such
uncles,
a disconnect in kind of multi-generational living, you know, and we grew up in small town Nebraska, so we probably experienced it more than most people of the small town community, where your family is known by everyone for good or bad. And sometimes that led to overvaluing just image. I think that's a problem in small towns of, oh, everyone knows us, so you better behave. But there was an aspect of like your family is well known, and there's older people, like, you know, if you're doing something wrong, whoever's sees you walking down the street, you know, has permission to slap you alongside the head. And, you know, that's how it works in small town.
Yeah. And whatever you did gets home before you did. And they're like, I know. And you're like, what?
Yes. But this aspect of community and tribe, and you talk about that a lot in your book. And we had, and I think that obviously COVID didn't help and shutting down the world and isolating us. And then we're always stuck on our phones and social media. And so we need to live life with other families where there's adults and other kids and people speaking into our families who know us deeply or walk alongside us just doing life together. And, you know, I grew up in a place where you pop into everyone's houses and it's okay. It's like, oh, like there's probably food on the table if it's 6 p.m. And so I guess I'll eat with them. And now it's like that's such a foreign concept of just having these open doors and natural community. And I think we can invite that and we can build that into our life. So our kids have more than us, but they have other adults who are really speaking into them, who know them deeply, who see them at their best and see them at their worst. And our kids can learn from them.
Yeah. Well, and that was another thing that I learned in some of my trainings was that a kid needs, they say kids used to need like one adult could kind of pour into like 15 different kids because the home structures were so strong. But we've so torn down the family now that every one kid needs at least five loving, caring adults sharing the same message in order for them to be successful and to really make it through life. And I think the family home is the most important because that's what hit me. I remember sitting when I was doing the drug and alcohol counseling and we were looking for protective factors and risk factors. And we were trying to build up strengths in kids and teach them coping skills so that they wouldn't turn to drugs and alcohol, but would be able to turn to healthier things. And so as I'm talking to some of these different kids and recognizing what their life and what their community are like and how much dysfunction they're constantly around. And I realized when I give them healthy coping skills, I'm speaking a foreign language. I might as well be speaking Greek because they've never seen it done. They have no idea what I'm talking about. It's not modeled on TV anymore. Even though the old shows like Leave It to Beaver were, you know, kind of cliche, they actually modeled healthy relationships and communication and like model running of a family. But now TV's like, let's just model the most dysfunctional family.
Yes. Yes.
No function.
And the dad is always a doofus who's not needed. Oh, and
yes.
You know, it's just it models dysfunction and we get a good laugh out of it. But we don't have a lot of models of healthy family. And then, you know, people who just fill in the gaps of what kids are missing. And so if you have the family next door, single parent household, fill in that gap. You know, I think of, you know, the Andy Griffith show. It's like, okay, the mom wasn't in the picture, but Aunt B filled in the gap. And, you know, look for the needs of kids. And as parents, let other people invest in your kids. And then also, we should all be just looking for the gaps that need filled in some kids' lives around us.
Yeah. And I think too, going back to your point of like letting people into our homes, everybody thinks now that, oh, I don't want anyone to come in unless they see my perfect home. But really kids need to see dysfunction. They need to see, not in an unhealthy way, but like they need to see messes. They need to see fights. Healthy fights. Yeah. They need to see people disagree and still be able to love each other and stay together and not throw things at each other.
This is real life. Yeah.
Yes. And so I think there is nothing more powerful than a family who allows other kids into their home and into their family and just seeing how different families operate. And every family has their like rules that are unspoken that just are the way things are. And you don't, and so you just learn those, you observe those, you know, like in my family, we are a very open family. We could go into our parents' bedroom. It didn't matter. Doors, no locks. And then I went to my cousin and then my cousins, we lived really close. So we'd go over to their house all the time while their family was, you'd never go into their parents' room. So I walked into their parents' room and my cousin was like, oh my gosh, you're going to die. I was like, why? I go to my parents all the time. And it was just a simple thing, but it taught me, I was like, oh, well, someday as a parent, if I want to have like my bedroom be off limits, it can be off limits. If I want to be like my family and have it be open, it can be. And so you see different ways to live and communicate and you start to recognize like my family isn't the only way and I can learn from other people and I can take the good and I can, you know, put aside the bad and I can look at my own family and be like, I didn't love this. And then I can see how other families operate and be like, oh, I'm going to take that in, you know, and which I've loved being, getting to, I have a million nieces and nephews, and so I would spend a lot of time at their different homes, and I just got to see so many different parenting styles, and it all worked perfectly for each family, but they were all so different, and all of their kids are turning out wonderfully, but they all parented like night and day different.
Yes. At Calibrate Ministries, we have an entire ministry just for parents of LGBTQ kids, because we want to be able to shepherd your hearts and encourage you and pray for you and your family as you navigate these situations. So just go to calibrateministries.com and fill out the contact form, and I'd love to be in touch with you about how you can be involved in that ministry.
I really think it's important for parents to have people in their life who are their tribe, away from their kids. So many parents isolate themselves. They don't have other people who speak in their life and who call them out on things and encourage them. So if we're saying, hey, don't get your identity from your kids, we have to also say, well, then how do I get my identity? And part of that is having a good tribe of healthy people around you who can have the right to call you out, like, hey, This is something I noticed. You might just want to be aware of it, and that we take it. Because a lot of times I've noticed that parents, if someone says something that they don't want to hear, they kind of shut those people out.
Yes.
But we need,
like, who are they to criticize me? We take it so personal.
Yeah. And so I think it's really important for parents, if they don't want to find their identity in their kids so that they can be better parents, they need to have people in their life who they've given permission to say hard things. And have those kind of harder conversations. And then they also need people in their life who will encourage them and build them up and be like, no, you're doing good. And like, to process and talk things through. It's super important to not parent in isolation, I think.
Absolutely. And that's part of, you know, that's great advice for anyone. But as I relay that to Christianity, it's like, man, part of the Christian life is I need discipleship and I need community, and we can develop those habits whether we're Christians or not. But I need people to process, like, what am I seeking? What's my heart feeling? What goals do I have them off? How am I sacrificing my family for the sake of this? And I shouldn't be doing that. And who's questioning that in my life? And we need people to question everything. And we need to give people permission to question everything. And sometimes when they question, it's like, oh no, actually that's fine. There's nothing really off there, but thank you for asking. And thank you for caring enough to ask. And
yes.
Having that type of deep community, and then we model that for our kids of what it looks like to have some deep community where people are allowed to ask us hard questions. And it's interesting. I've been seeing some studies and a lot of chit chat, you know, kind of our older generations, they cry about how weak our younger generations are, which part of the older generations have, they all have their issues too. But there's this phenomenon, and I see it all the time, of people our age and younger where completely cutting off contact with their parents and their families and using the label as toxic. And I see that in, like, you know, everything is toxic. And so it's like, oh, have nothing to do with your family. They're all toxic. And I see that in, like, social Facebook dad groups. It's like, oh, yeah, how do I handle this situation that's with my, you know, parents and our kids? Like, oh, your parents are obviously toxic, so have nothing to do with them. And it's like, man, like, we're not teaching our kids to work through things. And so our parents didn't do a great job of that. And so it's just like, they were very hardened at times, I feel like. And then what our generation has kind of responded with being kind of, I don't know, I hate to use the term weak, but not able to deal with, you know, any type of hard conversations, relationships, and people speaking into us. And so, you know, our parents were all about the rules, and we're all about maybe comfort and easy, and we have a hard time navigating just hard relationships and disagreeing with one another and being able to move forward and love one another, even though we disagree.
Well, and I think that also goes back to identity, where I think the reason that parents turn to their kids for their identity is because they haven't found their own identity, and they're not finding their identity in Christ. They're not having people in their life who are speaking identity into them. They don't have friends and relationships that are challenging and growing them to be who they are. So then how can they, you know, in turn speak identity into their kids' lives because they're trying to find their own. And so we only grow, I think, when we have people who are willing to say those hard things. And I think a lot of it looks like advice, where when somebody gives you advice, if your identity isn't solid and you're not confident in yourself and who God says that you are, and knowing that you're not perfect, but that it's okay, and your identity is in performance, then when someone gives you advice, you're not going to hear it as advice. You hear it as, I'm a failure and you're attacking me and I don't like to be attacked and I can't handle that. So I'm going to shut you out. And I only want positive, only good vibes. And the reality is that we can't grow into the best versions of ourselves if we don't go through hard times and if we don't have some of those harder conversations that force us to look at ourselves. And so I always remember thinking about advice as sort of like a present, you know, like someone gives you a present and sometimes you get that present and you look at it and you're like, this is perfect. I love it. This is exactly what I need. Sometimes you look at that present and you're like, I do not need this. This is horrible. I hate this. Why did you give it to me? Mm. You know, and sometimes you look at it and you're like, you know, it's nice. You know, it's probably good, but you're just like, you know, in your mind, like, I don't need this for right now. So you do three things with it. If it's the present that you know you need and you love and you want, you start using it right away. If no matter what, if it's a present, you're not rude, right? You never say back to someone who gives you a gift, like, I hate you. How do you give this to me? Like, you are kind, you respond, you say, oh, thank you. If they give it to you and you don't like it, you say, oh, thank you. And then you take that present. And if you don't need it, you throw it away or you give it to someone else. Like sometimes, a lot of times, gifts that you don't like are perfect for someone else. And you re-gift and you never have to tell the person who gave it to you what you did with it because you graciously received it. Now it's yours to do with what you want. And then if it's something that, like, sometimes it's something you put on your shelf and you're like, I'm going to need this later. And then you pull it off like that. And I think that's how, if we can look at advice as like, this isn't against me as who I am. This is something that I can take as a gift and I can choose to, like, maybe I need to use it now. Maybe I'll need to use it later, or maybe it will be for someone else, or maybe it's
maybe
just something
I'll re-gift it, you know?
Yes. Yes. And instead what I see the generation doing, they go, oh, well, this is toxic. I'm not going to have these people in my life because the gifts that they give are bad. And it's like, well, or they maybe see something.
Yes.
Kernel of yes. Truth.
And they have their blind spots. And so then we need some discernment on, you know, and that's then it's like, as our parents' generation is speaking into us, it's like, okay, they have their own blind spots. So I need then some help on which gifts from them do I take? How do I make some changes from my previous generation? But I can still love them with their blind spots. Yes. And respect them and be secure. And I don't have to cut things off because I'm secure and I have my identity in Christ. Yeah. And in a healthy place.
You honor them by receiving it as a gift and then taking it to God. Do I need this? Do I not need this? And if you don't, give it away, put it, you know, like, but it's not your, that advice still isn't your identity. And I think if we could do that, if we could figure that out, because the saddest part about cutting off parents and the generations is like, okay, maybe you don't need them, but your kids do. Like, they need their grandparents. That's
absolutely. And I see so many parents our age, like in their 30s, cutting off their kids from their grandparents because the parents can't handle the uncomfortableness or awkwardness or just relational tension that they have with their parents. And so they're depriving their kids of a relationship with their grandparents. And I see that being so tragic.
Oh, yeah. I think there's just something really powerful that grandparents, I think, offer and can offer to kids too, because they kind of know you the best. And chances are, like, whether you realize it or not, you probably parent similar to your parents, either as a, like, act mm-hmm. of trying to be the opposite of them or just unconsciously mm-hmm. you're going to do what you saw modeled your whole life. And so your parents are the ones who can call you out on it the best, but it's just the hardest to receive from them, I think.
Absolutely. It takes some humility and being able to just handle the tension of relationships and hard things.
Yeah. But I think if we can, I think too, if you don't want to be what some parents forget that I've noticed through the generations, because I saw different family. I mean, most people, I feel like in Midwest Nebraska, like, you kept your family close and generations were there, but there were some parents who didn't make, like, I can think of a couple of families who they didn't make spending time with grandparents or other people a priority. And then those parents, when their kids got older, so like when my friends then got older and became parents, they cut their grandparents out. Because the parents had never taught the kids the importance of spending time with grandparents or spending time with other people. And so then their kids didn't make them a priority anymore. So you see these parents who, like, you shut out your grandparents, there's a solid chance you're teaching your kids to shut you out.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's devastating.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Crystal, one aspect that you address in your book is porn and depression, and you had some honest conversation about sex and walk alongside your kids. And so let's talk about that. And I think that one of the blind spots of small town Nebraska or parents' generation is that you don't talk about those things. And yeah. I have so many parents who will ask at like Q&A events, like, when do I have the talk with my kids? It's like, you don't have the talk with your kids. You have thousands of talks with your kids as they develop, as you help them process what are they observing about relationships and the purpose of relationships, and then sex and emotions and feelings and attractions and hormones. And I so much appreciated you digging into that and understanding we need to be walking alongside our kids with these hard issues at every level of their development.
Yeah. First, like the first conversation is the most powerful. So the first time that your kids hear anything, that will have one of the biggest impacts on them. So if you really, they say most boys have looked at porn, was it by 8 now, or is it even lowered?
Yes.
It might even be lowered.
And that's so tragic.
Yeah. And so then that's their first understanding of what sex is, of how to, like, what a woman's body is. And it's instantly sexualized and it's instantly a visual thing and completely disconnected from the humanity of the person and the relationship of the person. And so those first conversations are really important. So we grew up on a ranch in Nebraska, you know, and so you just see animals everywhere. So for us, it was like, those conversations happened really young. Like, Mom, what's that bull doing to the back of that cow?
We just had that yesterday with our donkeys. It's mating season and little Jerry was getting the job done. And so Rowan is like 3. It's like, what's Jerry doing? And it's like, I'm not ready for that conversation. So they're playing.
Yes. Yes, they're just having fun. But you know, you talk about like the science of it. And I remember what my mom did. And I was in a car seat when my mom had the first conversations with us. And I've talked to her about it. She goes, you know, she didn't feel like she was supposed to have these conversations with other kids, but she just had a sense with me. She's like, I just knew for you, Crystal, I needed to have this conversation earlier. And she did. There were things that happened in my life at a very young age that weren't good. And because she'd had this conversation with me early, I was able to tell her about it and stop abuse before it ever really became horrific. And so, but I remember sitting in my car seat and the way she would talk about it was through the lens of love. And she would talk about like what love is and what love isn't and how our bodies are made. And so she would talk about the progression of a relationship. So I remember being in my car seat and having her hand on the dashboard. And she's like, now someday you're going to look at boys. And I know they seem really gross right now, but someday they're not going to seem gross. And you're going to be like, oh, and you're going to look at him. It's going to be so exciting. And you're just going to want him to look at you. And then he's going to look at you and it's going to be so exciting. But then pretty soon that's going to get boring. And so then you're just going to want to talk to him. And the first time you talk, it's going to be, oh my gosh. And you'll have butterflies, but then that'll get boring. And so then maybe you'll start holding hands and then, oh goodness, that'll be so exciting and the most amazing thing. And she's like, and I know this is the grossest and it's just going to make you want to throw up in your mouth, but you know what? You might want to kiss him someday. Like me and dad kiss. And my brother and I are like, oh, gross. No. And so she, you know, she went through all these stages and she's like, now all of these are actually leading you to sex. And that was how she started the sex talk. She's like, it's not just the physical act of sex. She's like, you're actually going to be getting attached to a guy from the minute you start talking to him and holding the hands and all things. And so then she would say, I mean, in my car seat, she's like, so you're going to have to draw a line and you need to know what your boundaries are. And she was like, and really, I think your boundaries should probably be holding hands. Like how cool if your first kiss was on your wedding day, like you know, was intense. And I don't know that every parent needs to do that, but it became a normal conversation. So when I was in kindergarten or second grade, I had a friend and her mom, she started asking her mom those questions and her mom gave her romance novels to read, like really graphic ones.
Oh, wow.
So she would give me those romance novels to read. And then I would talk to my mom about it and explain to her what was happening. But I wasn't like, but I knew, like I'd read these novels like, oh, that's not what love is or sex is, because my mom had already explained like what love is, what love isn't, what sex is, what it isn't, what it's supposed to be in, and the bounds, and which was perfect for my personality. Now, my sister's personality, they didn't have those conversations until she was much older, and she wasn't exposed to anything. She didn't see anything. She didn't look at anything. It would have been probably scarring for her if my mom had started younger. So I think that's another thing I talk about in the book, is like, as a parent, you kind of have to trust your gut with your kids a little bit, but also know that like, these are conversations that you want to start having at a young age, because they'll probably start young and age appropriate. And, you know, but I think really talking about what love is and what love isn't, yeah, you can have at the earliest ages. And I think that is really profound. Like sharing your love story as a couple, like kids love their parents. And so I remember our favorite thing to ask our parents was like, how did you fall in love? How did you propose? Aww. What was your wedding like? And, mm-hmm. you know, and we're sitting there and we didn't have devices at that time. And so you just would talk about what their love stories were. And then it kind of created this foundation of like, real love isn't Cinderella. Like real love is my dad, like stalking my mom in a pickup truck and her finally talking to him and her being like, I don't know if I really like you, you know, like that's what happens in a relationship. And versus, you know, the Cinderella, and then they kiss and that's how they know it's love. And in theirs, it was like, no, your dad pursued me and he got to know me and he proved himself. And so I think that having those conversations and really humanizing the conversation of what love is and relationship is can kind of help, because the pornography and the images with the boys especially, and the girls too, like so many girls are starting to get into it as well. Like in the romance novels that they read, like some of my high school girls, I started reading some of their books and I had to tell them, I was like, you guys, this isn't what sex is like this is really bad. Like this is porn and you wouldn't want this in a relationship. And don't think that this needs to be your standard. And if you're with someone and you don't feel like this, then it's not love, because this isn't love. But their moms aren't having that conversation with them. Mm-hmm. And how much better it, you know, I mean, it'd probably be less awkward for them to have it with their mom. Or maybe it's, I mean, at teenagers, it's kind of sometimes easier to have that conversation with someone else. But I'm like the first person who's told them, hey, that romance novel, that romance movie, or like that porn that you're watching on TV, that's not real. And I remember I was talking to this one kid and he had done some pretty horrendous things. And I actually had to make some phone calls because of some of the stuff that he told me. But he just was so, because of his porn use, just completely disconnected. Like he did not recognize that what he had done, that there was a human on the other end who had value and matter and purpose, and that God loved them and they should be cherished and taken care of. Like the porn had so desensitized his brain that he just saw girls as objects. I mean, it was so sad to me, because it was like, I can tell him, but I don't know how to like teach him. Like this is like, his brain has literally, I think, been changed because of the porn.
I deal with so many parents who are so shocked by their college age child's sin. And what they say is, oh, I did everything I could to protect them from the world. And I have to tell them, oh, your child's greatest threat wasn't the world. It was their own heart. And no amount of trying to make them live in a bubble to protect them from the world is going to give them a new heart. And they need a new heart. And their heart is going to twist something no matter what. And so it's this balance of, we do need to try to protect them from pornography and just abuse and so many horrible things out there, but also we shepherd them. We that does not replace shepherding their hearts and engaging deeply. And what is a healthy relationship? What is sex all about? What are these feelings you're having? We shepherd them through all that. And so I think we have to find that balance, or I don't even want to say a balance, because it's not either or, it's both, and of protecting them from the world, but also shepherding them deeply and engaging with them and helping them interpret what they're observing, because they're all going to be observing stuff no matter what. And we want them to be interpreting. We want them to be interpreting what's going on around me and observing, and then, but we help them have the right interpretation of that. I have pastors and church leaders regularly reach out to me about speaking at their churches and events. If that's something you would be interested in, feel free to go to calibrateministries.com and fill out the contact form, and I'd love to talk to you about what that would look like.
Yeah, well, and I think that's where training comes in, right? Like, if you shepherd your kids and you train your kids, because if they're only shepherded, but like the world is going to come at them, like Satan is going to come at them, their sins, their own heart are all going to come against them. And if they haven't been trained, then they're sideswiped by it. Like if they don't know how to engage with the world, then the world tends to take them over. And I just recently was meeting with my mentor, and we're going through the book of Ephesians, and she shared that when her son was 7, they were reading Ephesians and they got to the armor of God. And he did a sermon or something on like a fun one. And he was preaching to her on the armor of God. And he was like, well, we wear the armor so that we can go into battle, so that we can fight and we can be in the world and like not be destroyed by the world because we have the armor on. And she just said, she was like, I was just mind blown because I had always thought of the armor as that protects me so that I won't get hurt, so that I'm safe from the world. And her son was like, no, the purpose of armor is to go into battle and to go into fight and to be able to withstand those things and to thrive and to not be taken down by them. And so I think that is where the training aspect, you know, like, I think that's why the Bible says train up a child in the way that he should go. Like, don't shepherd a child in the way he should go. Don't protect him in the way he should go, but train him so that he knows that these things are going to come and you've given him tools to know how to deal with them. And then you can, and one of the things I talk about in the book is the importance of traditions. And I think traditions teach, they give opportunities for your children to interact with the world, but still be in your home. And you can bring in these conversations. And then every year that tradition happens again and again, so they can see their growth kind of like on a chart, like, oh, last year I just participated. This year I'm leading. Last year I failed at this and this, but this year I did it right, you know? And so they can start to see themselves growing and maturing. And you as a parent can as well. But I think, you know, like looking at life of, you know, teaching them scripture, being in community, having a good tribe around them, which is community. And then, yeah, shepherding, protecting, but also, however, when it does come to porn and when it does come to cell phones, I do feel that a lot of parents don't take that threat seriously enough.
Like, absolutely. Absolutely.
So that particular topic, I don't feel like it's one that you necessarily train. I think that's why the Bible says flee from sexual sin.
Absolutely. there needs to be a lot more protection throughout childhood than just training to navigate this. As like, no, that there's times when we protect and we're not going to put this in the hands of a child. And so,
yeah.
Because it has such horrible damage on kids, and it rewires their brain, and it helps them see people as objects, and disconnections from their feelings, and it's absolutely tragic. And so it's so hard because we want to train them to navigate the world, but there's also a level of protection at the same time. And it's like, with what I deal with people with, you know, sexuality issues all the time and how I see social media affect them and pornography. It's like, oh man, my kids aren't going to have a cell phone till they're 32.
yeah.
Cause it's so tragic. And so we do need to take that more seriously, but then also train them to navigate the world at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're training your kid in self-control in general, then when they're out of high school and their brain is, you know, has like had it, I mean, it's not finished developing, but like the most formative stages are kind of done. And then they want to have a cell phone. That's different because you've taught them to control them, their impulses. You've taught them to control their urges. You've taught them how to love people and how to see people and how to like live a good life. And now you can give them this phone and it can truly be a tool. I think what happens with a lot of families is they give the phone too early. They give the social media too early. The brain isn't developed. And they literally can't learn self-control because that part of their brain, like the prefrontal cortex, isn't developed until like later in your teen years, really. And so you're like, use self-control here. Like, let's think rationally about this. And the cell phone is rewiring their brain as well, right? Like all those apps are, they give a dopamine rush. I didn't hear this study until after I'd written the book, but I wish I had heard it because I would love to go back and look more into it. But they have started to look at for boys and video games and what that does to their brains and how important it is for their social development to play with other boys and to, And so when they play video games, they automatically get a dopamine rush, guys and girls, both. And the dopamine rush, like, is supposed to teach your brain to do healthy things. So in your teen years, that dopamine rush you're supposed to get when you succeed at something, when you do something hard and you accomplish it, and you get this huge rush and it makes you want to try hard things and keep working hard to do them. Or you walk through a difficult conversation and you get to the other side, or a relationship is broken and then it's restored. You get dopamine rushes and all these things, but it's after kind of a hard, like, there's a bit of a trial in there. Or you're, you know, you're depressed and you're tired, but you go on this hike and you see this view and it's like, ah, you know, and it teaches you, when I'm depressed, if I go on a hike, I feel better. But what happens is when they play the video games, they push the button and the button gives them the same dopamine rush. And so they just want to push the button. They keep pushing it. And so literally then for them, when they're sitting in a conversation, like around a table without their device, without the video game, it is actually physically painful for them because they have rewired their brain to be so addicted to this button. And so for boys, in their teen years and in their childhood years, where now they're starting to just play video games all the time, they're not learning how to interact. They're not learning how to play. And so much of their identity and their ability to take charge and to go into the world and to be confident and is done through playing games and failing and getting hurt and getting the dopamine rush that you get from, like, working really hard at a sport. But when they get it from the video game, they want to just keep doing the video game, and or the pornography, either one. Pornography also gives a dopamine rush. And it is, like, so dangerous. It's like, oh my gosh. It's like we're giving pure 100% alcohol to babies, and we don't even know the damage we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we need to take some of those issues much seriously as parents. But I love your book because it gives so much hope. And so I think we'll just end with, I need to give another strong plug for your book, because it's such a great combination of science, life experience, lots and lots of humor, some healthy amount of bathroom jokes, but so many practical tools to understand teenagers. And I don't want to just scare parents. I want to equip them. Like, you guys have what it takes. Like, you can engage and you can grow in the process, and you can correct, you know, dysfunction from previous generations, and you can grow and connect with your kids deeply. And you have the tools of what it takes, and your book helps provide a lot of those tools. And so we will have a link to it on our show notes, and I'll make sure I send out the link when we promote it. And
can I grab really it really quick?
Yes. And show it to you? Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So
yeah, there it is. There, Toilet Tales: How to Survive the Shit Show.
Yep, surviving the teenage shit show. So one thing that I really wanted, I just had this picture of a toilet on a mountain with flowers in it, because I thought, you know, the best gardens come out of really good manure, and yes, I think the best stories
that's
in life,
farm life right there,
yeah, come out of hard things. And so I just wanted to be like, no matter what hardships you're going through with your kids, there's hope. So I was like, a toilet is just hilarious. So I was like, hope and humor, that's what I was going for with this book cover.
Awesome. I love it. So, well, Crystal, thank you so much for joining us. I hope everyone checks out your book, and great gift. And so check it out, order some for a few people, send it as a gift. And I think that anyone who interacts with teenagers will be absolutely blessed by it.
Oh, thanks, Brady.
So cool. All right. Well, everyone, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Calibrate Conversations. We pray that as you go out through your week, you can equip God's standard for your sexuality and relationships. Make sure you check out our website, Calibrate Ministries, for more resources. Check out our YouTube channel, subscribe, like us on Facebook, all those things. We really appreciate it. Share with your friends. Thank you so much. We will see you next week.